There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile, hour number two on this Wednesday. The way I see it, it's almost like the weekend now. Second half of the show on a Wednesday is like Friday Eve. So enjoy it like that. Live local talk this hour. You're a big part of the show, of course, at 343-0106, 343-0106. I laid out my email, I laid out our phone and text line, and I laid out my Twitter feed, and I have gotten messages on all platforms here in the last 7 to 8 minutes. I got a couple messages this morning when I mentioned it, getting them more, and we are going to dig into this going forward because it seems like I was the last person in who did not get the memo that there was gambling going on the kids. We're talking about municipal, we're talking about park ball, y'all, that there's gambling going on park ball. This all started from that note from MPD. Said they were getting complaints about, I'll use a technical term, goings-on out at Langham and Maytree Park because they said there was drinking and smoking marijuana and gambling. And so this morning I said, you know, flippantly, I said, oh, they're throwing dice or something like that. That's just what I pictured. And then Dalton had said something about it. Then we started getting emails about this, sports betting. It's not sports betting at the casinos in Mississippi. This is sports betting at these parks. And I'm now, you know, and like I said, I'll keep you anonymous, but I've gotten people telling me they've seen up to one person said $3,000 bet during a Pee Wee football game. This one was at NAVCO. Seeing people confirming that it had gone on at Municipal Park. So I've doubled back and asked questions, made sure, are we serious? We're talking about park ball, little kids, and people are betting money on the outcome of those football games. I mean, this is not a PSA or anything, but if that's you, you have a problem. If you think that somehow you're compelled to bet on a little children's football game, you got a problem. All right, but I'm going to work this story up. We're going to try to get some people in the know on this and put something together for later this week. But now we will switch gears. And I mentioned this. I mentioned it yesterday, and I said I hope to get John Sledge in studio to talk about this. And lucky for me, I look up, and he is in studio because the Battle of Mobile Bay, the time period is a 2 or 3 week time period that you can consider being the lead up and the aftermath and the actual battle of Mobile Bay.
Yes.
And by the way, thanks for coming back.
Oh, no, I appreciate it, Sean. It's always a pleasure.
Of course, people know you from your writings and your history books and the definitive book about the Mobile River, which is one of my favorite reads ever. And then I think about the Battle of Mobile Bay. It was kind of set off a little bit because the water balloon battle happened downtown yesterday. And I wonder how many people that come out to throw water balloons at each other in Cathedral Square have any idea what they're commemorating.
Yeah,
something pretty big.
Yeah, well, it's sure. It was a consequential battle. And the actual conflict took place on the morning of August 5th, 1865, so 154 years. Then after the Union gained control of the bay, they besieged Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines. And that went on for a little bit longer. But yes, a presidential election in part hinged on it, as well as whether or not Mobile would continue to be a viable blockade running port for the Confederacy. So it settled a lot of things. Also demonstrated the importance of torpedoes, what we would call mines in naval warfare, rifled guns, ironclads against wood. So it was the end of sail and steam and the introduction of iron and a whole new era.
Yeah, it seems like it was one of those transition points. It often happened in a war where the technology, the war started off, whatever war, and it could be, you know, I'm thinking about even World War One being like that, where one set of technologies is what came into it. But at some point during the war, because of the increased pressure to win, something new, there's a sea change.
Yes,
no pun intended, I guess.
Every war starts with the previous war's technology, and wars generally escalate. And so the Civil War
started, does the technology.
Yes. What starts out seeming almost quaint ends up being incredibly dangerous for the future.
And that's what was brought to bear here on the Battle of Mobile Bay. And, you know, you mentioned some of the different technologies going on. I mean, give us an idea, perspective-wise. And I want to get back to the presidential election thing, too, because I think that is lost sometimes.
Yeah.
We learned it in our history books, but if we're watching a documentary and all that, it often stays with just the war aspect of it more than what was going on in Washington.
Politics.
Yes, in politics, and that's key. But the idea of the difference in technology between what you said was quaint at the start of the Civil War to what we were talking about when you start talking about ironclads and rifle guns.
Yeah.
I mean, how big of it? I mean, that's...
it was a game changer. Farragut knew he had a fleet of something like 20, 22 wooden vessels, and we're talking big warships, steam screw sloops with 15 or 20 guns and several hundred men, and these were formidable weapons. But he knew that they would be, you know, tinderboxes against these ironclads like the Tennessee, which was built in Selma, floated down. I mean, she had, 2 feet of oak siding with 5 inches of railroad iron on top of that?
Well, and we often ask that question. I mean, I know we do not get a boat right on the show, but it seems like it's like, how does that thing even float?
Well, yeah, I mean, it drew 13 feet, which was a problem getting it over the Dog River Bar. But once it was floating, Farragut knew, if this gets among my wooden fleet, we're going to lose.
Right.
So he had to have ironclads, and that's why he waited until the morning of the 5th, and the day before the Tecumseh arrived, along with a few others. So he had 4 ironclads to challenge the Tennessee.
But the technology on both sides, it was brand new, right? I mean, it was brand new for the Confederacy. It was brand new for the Union. I mean, these navies, it's not like they'd, we've been running ironclads a long time.
No, they were transitioning. It wasn't the first time they had faced them, but they knew they were formidable and that they had to be challenged with something of equal might if they were going to prevail. And the other technological advantage the Confederates had were the torpedoes, as they called them, which were essentially mines, basically a beer keg coated with pitch on the inside, filled with black powder, with a priming pin on the outside, usually anchored to the bottom by a chain. So anything that bumped it would hit that cap, spark it on the interior, and explode. And so his ships were incredibly vulnerable to those. Fortunately for the Union fleet, a lot of them had been sitting out there for months, the torpedoes, that is. So pterodactyl worms had gotten into them, or they'd leaked. So not many of them actually ended up being functional.
So water had gotten into the gunpowder.
Yeah. So what happened when the fleet comes in, the Yankee tars down in the holds of these Union ships could hear the hulls bumping and thudding against these torpedo kegs, but they weren't exploding.
Can you imagine that feeling?
So you talk about terrified.
Holy cow.
And they'd seen what happened to the Tecumseh, which did hit a functioning torpedo.
Now, as you know, we talk about these, and we're going to go to break here in a second, come back, but this goes into, of course, the vernacular of Americans. Still used today. I mean, that's what's so significant. We you know, look at something 154 years ago here in our backyard, in the Battle of Mobile Bay, that somewhere in the United States, in probably every state today, somebody will say, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Yeah, Tom Petty did an album.
Yeah, one of his best. But, I mean, if, you know, there's arguments that exactly what what Farragut said, it was damn the torpedoes, go ahead, full speed ahead. But, I mean,
some version, and it involved profanity. They got the message.
Right. And then, you know, we come back from the break. I think about things like being lashed to the rigging and things like that that I've heard over the years, and these things that come out of these few days right here.
Yeah,
and
couldn't make it up.
And we'll talk about also what rests on the bottom of Mobile Bay, not only from that battle, but you've come in here before and given me numbers for the number of shipwrecks in our area. And y'all, it's going to Well, I was going to say blow you away, but we don't want to say that. All right, we don't have any torpedoes waiting for you. Head to the news break. Coming right back, John Sledge, our guest. Remember, phone number, text line 343-0106.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 120 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. I'm glad to have you here. Good to have John Sledge in. Historian, of course, and author. And if people want to come out, are you doing, I know you have different events coming, you know, over time where people can come out and talk about whether it's a certain subject or books or history of the city. How do they get in touch with you? How do they get that information?
Well, not doing much this summer, but I will be doing a tour of the Lower Delta from Blakely State Park in October. The 13th, I think. They could call the park or go to its website and sign up for that. It should be a lot of fun. We go out and look at the sites involved with the Battle of Blakely. We also look at the Sunset Limited accident site on Bayou Canoe, talk about the Clotilda, come down through the harbor, spend a nice half day on the water.
Which, speaking of which, let's link things together, as we can do fairly easily in a 300-year-old city, because we're talking about the Battle of Mobile Bay, but you mentioned the Clotilda, and I'm thinking about Jack Friend's book, West Wind and a Flood Tide, which what a fantastic book. Read, which I've suggested to people if they want to read a great book about the Battle of Mobile Bay. But then I was reading a review somewhere one time that he himself had looked for the Clotilda.
He did. He looked up in Bayou Canoe back in the, I guess it was the early 2000s, had some equipment. It wasn't the most sophisticated, but he did a search of the entire bayou, the length of the bayou there, and found some anomalies, but was not able to identify them with the time and the money that he had. So there's just so many shipwrecks up there. Everything's from lumber boats to barges to schooners and who the heck knows what. Sorting out what you're finding is really the tricky part.
Yeah, just saying, hey, I found some boat that sunk somewhere north of the Mobile River. Okay.
Yeah, because it's one thing we've learned is that stretch around the east side of 12 Mile Island where Ben Raines thought he had recently found it, that was actually a maritime graveyard. There's schooners and ships and hulks up in there that were just abandoned.
Like basically today's junkyard?
But exactly, including two Civil War ironclads at the south end of 12 Mile Island. So there's so much up there.
So two of the ironclads are up there?
Yeah, the Huntsville and the Tuscaloosa, which were both manufactured, and their engines were too weak to really power them. So they didn't go to the Battle of Mobile Bay, but they used them as floating batteries for Spanish Fort and Blakely. And then at the end of the war, they scuttled them right there in the Mobile River where the Spanish River breaks off from it.
Well, and those are some of the shipwrecks, you know, not all obviously from the Battle of Mobile Bay, but you've talked about the number of shipwrecks. There's some that are more famous in people's minds, but you say whether it's the Delta or the entire bay, we've got a ship graveyard here.
Oh, yeah, they're over, I forget the exact number, but it's over 200 easily.
Y'all think about that. You're 200 in our waters.
And some are quite well known among local fishermen. For example, the Dixie Bar is an old clipper ship that in, I think, 1860, suffered a hurricane and sank right there at the mouth of the bay, drowned about 20 members of its crew and its captain, who went down
with the ship. Like they're supposed to, right, yes.
And they're buried in Magnolia Cemetery, and it's now a well-known fishing spot.
What's neat about down there on that end is the way wrecks, at least from my experience, is just anecdotal, but they're exposed and then covered back up with routine. It's like they're there right now. You know, they're always there, but I mean, they're exposed or not exposed.
Like the Rachel, just east of Fort Morgan. Whenever it gets exposed, people are just fascinated by that.
No, like, we found a new wreck. No, y'all haven't, but
it's an old new wreck.
You know, and I want to mention this part of it too. We talk a little more about kind of the layout of how the battle went down, and I think about that picture of the maps in my office at home of how the battle went down. But the part that doesn't get, I think, as much conversation, and you referred to it right away, and that's what the Battle of Mobile Bay meant to the entire war and who would be leading this country, and would they continue to fight the Civil War?
Right. Well, Abraham Lincoln was president, of course. The war had been going on 4 years. The costs were horrific. Nobody could
have foreseen that. There was dissent. People don't think about that. I mean,
a lot of Union dissent, a lot of war weariness, and a lot of interest in perhaps a negotiated peace with the South.
Mm-hmm.
And people felt, you know, you had both the Mobile Bay going on at the same time that the Siege of Atlanta was going on, Sherman and Hood. And so those two epical battles were being watched by the whole world, really. And people felt if we lose these, then the northern public is just going to say, that's it, no more war, we're sick of it, we're not sending any more of our boys, find an end to it, whatever it is. If it means the South gets to go in peace and keep its slaves, then we accept that. So a lot hinged on that. Lincoln was locked in a re-election battle with General McClellan, the little Napoleon, they called him. He was a bit of a popinjay, this short Union general who'd achieved fame early in the war in the Peninsula campaign. So there was political opposition to Lincoln, and that election, of course, was that November. So Farragut prevails at Mobile Bay in August, and Sherman in Atlanta in September, and starts his march to the sea. And Lincoln recaptures office handily, and he has a mandate to finish the war, whatever.
But had those one or two of those events not gone the same way, there's a chance, we don't know, but a chance that it would not have worked out that way for Lincoln.
Well, exactly. And Farragut's great challenge. He's sitting there on his ship. He's just watched the Tecumseh hit a torpedo and sink with 90-plus men aboard. Her propeller, as one witness said, wildly clawing the air, and then she shot to the bottom like an arrow twanged from the bow.
Oh, wow, what a description.
His decision right there is, my God, do I back off or do I go ahead? And his lead ship is the Brooklyn. She starts backing her crews. Everybody in the Union fleet is panicking, saying, you know, she's hit a torpedo, we can't go on. Farragut's in the Hartford right behind the Brooklyn. He's lashed to the rigging, as you mentioned, up in the foretop.
Yeah, and explain that to people. We've talked about lashed to the rigging. He physically had one of his members he's lashed to it, so he can't fall down.
He climbed up the ratlines to the main top in the main mast so he could see over the smoke and powder and issue orders to his pilot who was standing next to him. But he's clinging to the futtock shrouds just below the platform. And one of the officers of the Hartford looks up and sees, you know, our admiral could get pitched into the bay without much trouble. So he orders a young man up to lash him to the rigging, and Farragut says, leave me alone, and the young man did it anyway. And so there he sat for the duration of the battle. He says, you know, what's wrong with the Brooklyn? Why didn't she go ahead? She's got enough water. And they say, well, her captain signals that Tecumseh's hit a torpedo, and that's when he issues his famous command, of which we have 27 versions.
We'll go with
damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. He knew that if more torpedoes were working, he faced a potential catastrophe. That was a very real and courageous decision, but he was going to go into that bay no matter what. It could have cost him his flagship. It could have cost him half his fleet. God knows what the public reaction would have been to that, or what the consequences to Lincoln would have been had it been a bloodier victory than it was. But he took the risk. Fortunately, more torpedoes didn't work. He clobbered the Tennessee, and though at significant cost, he took Mobile Bay.
If just joining us, talking to historian and author John Sledge, and I got to ask you, John, give us an idea in today's world, or we can move it to World War II. And loss of naval assets, obviously, with, what did that mean? Did the Tecumseh, what does that mean to a fleet back then? Is that a destroyer? Is that a cutter? You know what I'm saying? In size, how big a deal was it losing that ship?
It was a huge deal because it would be, I don't want to equate an aircraft carrier and an ironclad, but it was a critical.
How big of an asset to that Union Navy was that?
I mean, it was one of the best vessels they had. It was their best ironclad in that fleet.
And it's gone.
It was their best ship, and it's gone with 100 men. It's an unseen weapon. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting was the reaction after it hit the mine and sank. There was just silence on both sides. The firing stopped, and everybody was like slack-jawed.
They were surprised that it happened.
Well, yeah, and it was just like you've seen in 100 lives instantly snuffed out, and it was like the war is the real enemy here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what would we cheer for? This could be us,
right?
If it, you know. So it was an astonishing point in military history.
So this is going on, and going on the south end of the bay, situation in Mobile at that time.
Well, the city, they could hear the firing, and some people panicked and wanted to evacuate, or refugee, as they called it, get away as fast as they could.
They used it as a verb, to refugee.
Yeah, let's refugee.
Okay.
And others, there's a description from a young teenage girl who was like 16, and she and her friend were at the breakfast table, and they heard the bells going crazy in town. And then they heard the rumble of the guns, and they ran outside, and there were just crowds surging down to the waterfront to hear and see what was going on. And she said, you know, we knew that Farragut's fleet was running the forts. And some people said, well, the forts will hold, we're fine. Some said, well, they might get into the bay, but they can't get up here. The water's too shallow. We have strong defenses. So it was a momentous occasion.
And there were the strong were defenses, and reading your books, too, about what was done, you know, here in Mobile, out in front of the mouth of the river. You know, we're picturing now, I mean, Big Duffy Coal Terminal and all that in Little Sand Island, but there were things out there if they get through here, we're going to stop them here, right?
Obstructions and batteries and smaller ships and earthworks and all of that, but... what happened after the bay fell is the city's strategic significance as a blockade port was ended. But the city remained in Confederate hands until the following spring when it fell after Spanish Fort and Blakely.
And that's what you're, of course, talking about this fall when people come out and do that tour of the Lower Delta.
Exactly.
And if somebody is going to be... You know, versed enough. You know, I would love people to dive into a book or two on this and get versed on the Battle of Mobile Bay and its significance. Where do you send them?
Well, the first thing I would say is, I think Jack Friend's book is a really good overview. And if I can plug my own book,
yes.
These Rugged Days,
yes.
Alabama and the Civil War, I have a chapter on the Battle of Mobile Bay, and it's not for military historians. It's for the average reader.
That's why I love it, because I am the average reader.
So, and I want people to know that the battle was consequential, but it was not a foregone conclusion the way it's often treated. It's like, well, we knew they were going to win. You know, Farragut did not know he was going to win. It was a chance. He took it. And to the victor went the spoils.
I'll do this. We're going to run to a news break. Can you hang out just a little bit longer with me? Because I think what you said there, too, and I've told people about this, that trying to look at history without knowing the outcome maybe makes us better students of what we're reading.
Yeah.
We'll continue our conversation with John Sledge. You got a question, you can text it in, call it in, 343-0106, 343-0106. This is Midday Mobile.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 135, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. And it's great to have John Sledge back in studio. We need to do this more often. We need to just go ahead and put it on the calendar like a regular thing because so many questions. Listen, and you are a font of information, and we have questions as an audience. I want to run through a couple things here. First of all, on the I don't know, I wouldn't even say this is a lighter note. It's just all the stories that are surrounding the history of Mobile and the Bay from the Civil War and trying to get somebody like you to weed out fact from fiction. A buddy of mine said, I heard that Farragut issued a shot or two of rum that morning before the Union ran the barricade. Is that true?
That's true. Buck the men up. Of course, in the British Navy, rum.
It had taken more than two shots.
But, but yes, they got a shot of rum, and
so that's a true.
That's true.
Okay,
yeah.
So they do that, and we're talking during the break as well. And I brushed right past it, and I shouldn't have, because I think people, as we talk about the all the shipwrecks in the bay and in the Delta, but probably the most famous and obviously significant to what we're talking about, the remains of the Tecumseh,
right,
still on the bottom of Mobile Bay.
Yes, it's marked by a buoy right off the end of Mobile Point there, and it's under about, I think, 40 feet of water with a layer of mud on top of it. It's upside down. It's been dove on a number of times, though it is considered a war grave and is monitored by the Coast Guard. So any attempts to loot it, obviously, will be met with severe consequences.
Right.
There's still 90-something men aboard. But parts of it have been brought to the surface by the Smithsonian years ago and are in the History Museum of Mobile. And there's a very good display on it as well, including a nice model down at Fort Morgan. And you'll get some sense of how big it was.
Yeah, and you're talking about the crew, 90 to 100 people.
Yeah, yeah. They call them cheese boxes, you know, because they're sort of flat in the water, and then they have that turret. But, of course, there's a deep hole below that.
Right.
And they had all
13 feet.
Yeah.
13 feet was
the draft.
Yeah. I mean, that's because, y'all, this is before dredging. So,
yeah.
I mean, you are limited in Mobile Bay even today at 13 feet.
Yes, and, of course, we're talking summer, and at that time, the temperatures below deck in that thing were probably 130 degrees. It was infernal.
Wow. And, you know, we talk about it being a grave, and we, when like during Mardi Gras, people, this will, people know when we have ships come to port during Mardi Gras.
Right.
They stop, and people will see they do a replaying ceremony, and that's there at the Tecumseh.
Yes, absolutely. They toss a wreath on the water. Sometimes the sailors, they'll have a couple of guys dressed in, you know, 1860s sailor garb and say a little prayer and remember that moment.
And that's a memorial like we were talking to, like the way the Arizona is, way
exactly.
It is at Pearl Harbor.
It's a war grave.
War grave. So, I mean, this is something that people probably run past that buoy a whole bunch and don't think about that's right here.
Exactly. And to give you some sense of the lopsidedness of the casualties in that battle, the Confederates only had 12 men killed. On their ships, but of course they were bested, outrun, driven aground, and they ultimately lost. But they had nothing like the loss of life that they did in the Union Navy.
What about the sieges of the, you know, we focus on the naval battle,
right?
And for rightful reasons, but the land battles to take the, I mean, there
sure.
was the naval portion of it, but weren't there land forces deployed? I don't know if they were called Marines back then or what they, but they,
there were Marines, but there were also Army troops who
okay.
landed. Well, they took Fort Gaines fairly quickly because the fort surrendered prematurely. The Confederate High Command thought, but Fort Gaines held out for another week or two, and there was just a terrific siege through late August. I think it surrendered the 27th or something like that, and the fort held out, but it was reduced practically to rubble, and you had even the Tennessee being used against the fort by the Union Navy, just thousands of rounds of artillery, while the Army came, you know, inched forward by trenches and poured musket fire into it, and it finally just became too hot to hold, and so the Confederates had to surrender.
Can you imagine? I mean, at that point, there's nobody coming to on your flank. There's no
right.
there's no assistance coming from
yeah.
from Mobile or other troops elsewhere. I don't know. Was Canby here at the time? Was he?
Canby was here, but he was General Granger was in immediate
okay.
command of the Union Army.
Okay,
there were several thousand soldiers on the peninsula.
That many?
Yeah. Yeah, several thousand Union soldiers and 400
imagine what that looked like.
Confederates. Oh, yeah. I mean, people still find things, belt buckles and, you know, shoe buckles and bullets down there.
You know, you mentioned then coming up this fall, and I'd love to be able to go with you on this as you tour the Delta, and one of those talking about the Battle of Blakely. Because,
right.
You know, people think, oh, well, that's all. There's time between those two events, Battle of Mobile
yeah,
Bay
months.
and then Blakely, to...
Yeah,
before
I mean,
that happened.
And there was a Mobile campaign, which was separate from the Battle of Mobile Bay, the battle of the final charge at Blakely, during which a lot of black troops participated, black Union troops, takes place 9 hours after Robert E. Lee had already surrendered at Appomattox. So that was really a needless battle, but there was no... You know,
no communication.
Communication. No,
there wasn't even
that.
There wasn't even like slow, there wasn't even any slow communication.
You're
it was
right.
really slow communication. But we think about sticking with the water aspect here and the area. People probably see, you know, like the battery. We talk about
right.
the battery in
right.
the Delta. That's Civil War era.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we had Battery Hugie, Battery McIntosh out there in the middle of the bay, like a little island on its own. Battery Gladden. It was heavily fortified. Farragut actually reconnoitered the upper bay after the battle. He came up in a light tin clad and with a spyglass was looking at the Confederate fortifications, and both sides were kind of booming away at each other from the obstructions. And he said that, you know, the city was essentially impenetrable. It would take 30,000 men to take it. And there was a Vermont carpenter who was stuck in town. He got stuck in the Civil War down here. And he said Farragut might as well have tried to sail through the Green Mountain Range
wow.
as to come through Mobile's defenses.
But you're saying as at the point that you know, the chance of getting out into the Gulf was
yep,
gone,
zero.
Then the really the right. value of our city for the war was not...
More, I mean, it was still valuable as a railroad transference point, communication between Eastern and Western theaters, its hospitals and stores and so forth were still important.
But it wasn't worth the loss of life that the Union would have taken, and the, obviously Confederacy would have taken as well.
Yeah, I mean, and it was another kind of ratchet in the long reeling in of the Confederacy. So it was bad news for the South.
Questions coming in here. This is, listen, y'all picked the right time to ask questions because it's not every day you have this man with the historical knowledge of our city in here that you do when Mr. Sledge is in. All right. Was David Farragut's uncle, I guess it's Jose or Josie Farragut, a captain of the Siege of Pensacola during the American War for Independence?
You know, that I don't know. It's a good question.
Okay.
I'm not that deeply versed. Farragut was a Southerner, though. He was born in Tennessee, I believe, and raised essentially in New Orleans and along the Gulf Coast. He had cousins in Pascagoula during the
war.
Did
he really?
So he understood Southerners, and he felt sympathy for them, but he remained loyal to the old flag.
Navy-wise, because, I mean, there's a lot of the game of comparison, people that armchair this and say, okay, well, look at the cavalry, and I was talking about Southern cavalry versus right. Union cavalry, and let's look at, the candidate, who's had better candidate, whatever these things. But the Navy discussion here, going into this, who had the upper hand as a Navy?
Oh, the Union all along had the upper hand. The Confederacy was forced on the defensive, and that forced them to be more innovative. So they tended to try things first, like submarine warfare and the Hunley, a whole other story that takes mm-hmm. place in Mobile, and it becomes the first submarine to sink an enemy ship in warfare off Charleston.
Yeah, remind folks, too. I mean, the Hunley, people think about it, it's the Charleston, here's the story of the Hunley.
Right.
But
built here.
Yeah, and moved how?
And tested here first in the Mobile River. But moved aboard a railroad flat car with a tarp over it and a guard.
That story is always just...
Yeah.
Because that could be, and I know I'm probably trying to do too many comparisons to modern day times, but I think it's worth trying to put it in perspective how valuable the Tecumseh was to see that lost.
Right.
Or a sub, and would that have been the stealth bomber of its day? I mean, was it was that big a thing?
It was a secret weapon. And if it worked, and if it could have been replicated, it really could have been a game changer. The South really saw that as their David, and that was a term they even used for these smaller torpedo boats that could take on the Goliath of the Union Navy. That'll enable us to break the blockade. They just didn't have enough men and enough submarines to do it.
More time, things could have been different, maybe?
Possibly, but it is amazing when you look at it what the South was able to achieve given the constraints and the lack of resources and the overwhelming superiority that the Union had. I mean, both sides made innovations, and really what ends the Civil War is what begins World War I, a very different, you know, trench warfare like you have at Blakely, and mines and ironclads and submarines, and all those things become routine.
Yeah, that's the thing to think about where you mentioned this transition. You come in at a quaint, quaint place at the end of the Civil War, you end up differently, and then that's the technology that's then the quaint technology right. at the beginning of the next war. And you go back to the early days, at least the Eastern Theater of the Civil War, they weren't trench. I mean, that would have been,
exactly.
Would have been looked down on.
Yeah, exactly.
And then by Blakely, I mean, we're still dealing with the earthworks from all the trenches that were at Blakely.
Absolutely. Amazing difference.
What a treat to get you in, and I appreciate this, folks. Once again, this is a battle that is, of world renown and at least national renown that's right here in our backyard and something
Amen.
Worth knowing about. And John Sledge giving us the information. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it.
All right, 145 FM Talk, 106.5, and we will, whether he likes or not, get John back on the show very, very soon. The book, The Mobile River, one of the many that you need to pick up if you live here. And, of course, you need to talk about Alabama and the Civil War, these rugged days, and that's on the bookshelf as well. Great reads. Y'all check them out. Put some links up on my Twitter feed where you can go right to them and get them purchased. All right, 146, we're coming right back. We'll check in with News 5 next.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile Wednesday style. You know, just about 9 minutes before the Paul Feinbaum show. And of course, tons of football talk as people are getting ready for what's coming up in, 2 weeks, 3 weekends, September 1st. The football games are starting, at least for our state schools. That's for sure. And speaking of which, if you've got some of that football fever and want to show it off, my buddy Angelo at Mobile Bay Coins probably has an idea or two for you. Hey, Angelo.
Hey, how's it going, Sean?
Going good. What about the, it was last year before we talked about the, for a couple of years, so it was, let me see, elephant embossed silver rounds. How about that?
Right, yeah, and that's exactly what we have to call them. It has nothing officially affiliated with any collegiate schools.
Right.
But
right.
It's a one-ounce silver round with an elephant on one side. It's engravable on the other side, so you can put your name, your initials. You could put a phrase if you want there, have that custom engraved. And we have those available exclusively here at Mobile Bay Coins. We just got a new order in last week.
Now, if somebody even wanted something for game day engraved, they could do that. But for sure, if they're thinking Christmas presents, things like that, that's something you can get completely customized.
Well, you certainly can. And it's been very interesting. They've started to go the way of the open-L knives. And when we first got these in, people would buy a open-L knife or an elephant round. Now they're coming in and buying them in, you know, 2, 4, 6, or 8 of these items because they know they're going to be a hot commodity with all their friends.
Yeah, that's you know, something we've talked about, the pre-purchase of gifts to be ready so you don't get caught unaware. And I got to say, those two are present in my house in the present stash spot, open-L knives and those silver rounds. All right, what about in the world of precious metals? What's going on with silver? What's going on with gold?
Well, actually, it's a great time to buy. Gold and silver have both been dropping. Right now, gold is under, it's around 1177 right now, so it's well under 1200. Silver is well under 15. So if you've been thinking about starting a hedge with gold and silver, now is definitely the time to get your butt down here.
I like it. That's language I can understand. Well, give us directions then.
Yeah, we're in Midtown at 2204 Government Street. You can always call us at 725-1590 or go on to Facebook and like and follow Mobile Bay Coins there.
All right, Angelo. Thank you, man. We'll see you soon.
Have a good one, Sean.
You too. Angelo, check it in from Mobile Bay Coins. And by the way, big thank you for lots of questions here for John. And if you didn't get it answered, you can reach out to him through the History Museum, the Mobile Museum of History. I always do it backwards. The History Museum of Mobile or the Mobile Museum of History? I think it's the other way. I think it's Mobile Museum of History. Either way, you Google those words, you'll find the contact information, and he is absolutely a font of information about Mobile history and history at large. And also, thank you. There's probably enough here for me to work off of with the... I got to tell y'all, I'm just ignorant. Just ignorant. Even the people on Twitter, they're shocked that said I needed to get out more. I'm sorry, I've not been in the places to see the gambling going on for the Pee Wee football. But like Buddy says, I need to get out more. I do get out. Obviously, I'm not in the right place, or I'm not, you know, Buddy, I might not be cool, right? I might not like the bookies taking action on the 8-year-old football games. You know, I may not be able to spot them. I don't know what they look like. So. But I between emails here and text and social media post, there's enough here that we're gonna start looking into this. This is what it comes from. If you didn't hear earlier, reading up a press release came out, I think yesterday, the day before, from MPD, and it said Mobile police are increasing patrols at city parks to ensure public safety. Of recent, there have been reports of individuals gambling, consuming alcoholic beverages, and the sights and smells of people smoking marijuana at the parks. Based on the calls police have received, the incidents are occurring most often at Maytree Park and Municipal Park or Langan Park. And then they say during youth football games, because when I first heard it, I go, you know, I'm at Municipal Park all the time. That's where I walk. That's where I do. It's right near my house. I do my evening hikes and all that. And I don't see that. I don't see that going on. There's mostly ducks and geese. And children's birthday parties. That's what I see. But they point out when they say gambling during youth football games. So I said this morning, I'm picturing somebody throwing dice or something while the youth football game's going on. And I got the first couple emails that said, no, they're betting on the game. And the first email, I kind of laughed it off, said, yeah, well, that's a funny joke. Sure they are. There's a bunch of y'all that said, this is a thing in our city. I can get to the bottom of this. I'm just not a gambler, other than driving on the surface road here. Not a gambler, but the idea that people are wagering money on youth football games to be... I mean, I started early. Well, I guess I didn't start. I started for CYO, but I mean, half of us didn't know if we were on offense or defense on a given day. Our shoes might not have been tied, and we might not have known how to retie them. The idea that everybody would leverage money on the outcome of that kind of matchup leaves me scratching my head. But so it was a note from MPD just saying and reminding folks that there's prohibition on alcoholic beverages at any of the public parks. Possession of marijuana and gambling are arrestable offenses. And then they said, if convicted in the court of law, these offenses carry a monetary fine and up to 1 year in jail. Okay, so there was the actual press release. But the one with four words that I took away from that during youth football games is what kind of set this off. And then with y'all's information coming from the text line here, here we go. Okay, there's more of y'all. This is unreal. All right, we will dig into this. If y'all want to send emails, and of course, I'm going to keep everybody anonymous here. If you've got stories, give me some corroborating information, though. I mean, I'll keep you anonymous, but like so many people, they've told me the park, you know, they said it was this park, and it was this game, and these kind of things. Once again, I'm not the vice squad. I'm just making sure that this is a trend as it's being laid out here, that there are people gambling on these youth games. If somebody wants to call and give me an anonymous commentary on it, they can do it as well. I just got to tell you, I was bumfuzzled by the whole thing, but we'll dig into it. All right, Paul Feinbaum. On the way next, we'll be back tomorrow morning for Mobile Mornings. And remember, podcast of this show, the morning show, shows we have in the evening, weekend shows, fishing reports, garden shows, news shows. If you're looking for it and somebody said, hey, you should have heard that, or hey, they were talking about the way you gamble on your children's football games, they can go back and get podcasts of our shows by going to fmtalk1065.com, clicking the link for podcast. Or if you subscribe, if you're an iPhone person, you can go to iTunes. If you're an Android person like me, go to Stitcher. It's a great app. You can also use Spotify. If you get music there, you can get our podcast there as well. And if you use TuneIn Radio to stream the station on your smartphone, they also have our podcast on there as well. So check it out. And pass this along to your cousin who's gambling on that Municipal Park Raiders football game. All right. See you in the morning.